Hi everyone and welcome to Cooking Goals. You're listening to The Cooks. And here we talk to motivated people who are actually doing something, how they got to where they are and their goals for the future. The aim of this podcast is to inspire people to create goals for themselves, to push towards and surpass them. Whether it be small goals like running a 4-minute kilometer or big goals like owning a home, I want this space to be somewhere people can come for inspiration, to listen in on a great conversation, hopefully learn something and in the process create goals for the future. Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by The Daily Grind, a venture which I have started myself where I collect and redistribute used coffee grounds to the community. If you're interested in this venture, please get in contact with me via the link in the description of this episode. Today we talk to Adrian Nathaniel, author of The Yoga of Wealth and Prosperity Coach. How are you, Adrian?
Yeah, great, thanks. And you?
Yeah, good. I thought you were just telling me about a fantastic weekend you're going to go endure, which is great. Got some good weather. It's coming into summer now. Well, it's pretty much summer already, but it should be a good weekend for us both. I think I'm going surfing. Booked in a surfing lesson about a year ago. Can finally use it, so we'll see how that goes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and you're going down south a bit to do some activities as well.
Yeah. Doing some kirtan chanting tonight, and then. As we move into the full moon, some eclipse gazing as well.
Yeah, I did notice that. I remember back after looking at your website, you did mention that India was a place you'd go back to, I think, in that discussion group that we had that night. So, it's not a place I've been yet, so on the list for maybe 2025 or something. Yeah. Now, I like to start each episode of telling the listeners how we met. So Adrian and I are part of a group here on the Gold Coast called Social Impact Leaders Rise. Basically, it's a small group for, well, it's not really small anymore, actually, but it's run out of Karma Club Hub on the Gold Coast, and we talk about social enterprise and, I guess, businesses who are doing good rather than focusing on the financial gain and planet detriment, I guess, in terms of their products. But in these sessions, we usually get up at the start and introduce ourselves and I've been to one of these before, and then the second one I went to came a little bit late. I'm a bit of a late monkey, but I was put my hand up and spoke, and I mentioned my new social enterprise, Daily Grind. Talked about how I'm running into some, you know, financial issues and things like that. And kindly, Adrian came up to me at the end and said, "Hey, just like out of the blue, mate, I've got some information for you. I can help you out." So yeah, and I did follow up on that way, and I spoke to Jessica, so that was great. So. Networking is a good skill of mine and definitely a good skill of yours. It appears, so that's great, and I do appreciate that. So that's how me and Adrian have come together, and he showed me he had a podcast as well. So we'll get into talking about that at the end later today as well. But it was I'm glad to have you on to have a conversation today.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and I love your social enterprise too. I think there's a lot of potential for this at the moment, and the whole thing about groups like Social Impact Leaders Rise is to network, see if there's any ways of collaboration, and to connect you with other people that you might not know. So hope it works out.
Yeah. Now, and sometimes in these groups, you got to put yourself out there. There might not be someone who you could connect to, or there might not be something that could help you, but you could provide help to someone else. You know, so and that helps grow your network as well. So.
Yeah.
No, it's a great group, and I'm glad I beat a part of it, meet you and meet some other like-minded people. So, we'll see what happens with the Daily Grind. I'm very focused on my PhD at the moment, coming into Christmas time, trying to get some things wrapped up. So hopefully I get a bit of a break and then put my head around it and see what we can do. So see what happens.
I've got some other people for you to connect with as well around that. So
fantastic.
You know, the thing is that, yeah, like, if we're all in it together, and if we sort of open up and not try and maintain control of our little slice of something, if we open up, then we'll find that we can grow much bigger and make a much greater impact on the world around us. And at the same time, that you'll be surprised at the flow that'll probably support you financially as well. But anyway,
yeah,
we'll talk about that more.
Nah, yeah, we do that off air. I'd love to get some good contacts. I always love networking. But I definitely agree with you, and we'll go into talking about it this afternoon, where is if people just focus on the impact first, the money will follow. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like if
that's it.
Building that kind of, I'm trying to get that, I guess, concept across in my own head where I talk about, you know, the world's literally, I'm learning now, becoming an adult. It's turning into like, actually, I need money to move out. I need money to put food in the fridge, take my girlfriend out to dinner. Like, how do I get this? I've got to work. And I'm like, all right, well, how's this all going to interplay? So we'll talk about that today. But tell the listeners about yourself, Adrian. So just let's hear it all. So where have you come from? Where are you at now? What's been happening new? I'd love to hear your story, which we'll go into further today. But yeah, start us off.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a bit of a late bloomer, actually. I went to uni and I was doing a Bachelor of Psychology. And the reason why I was doing that, because I was, and still am, fascinated with human potential. However, you know, at the time, I didn't really feel like the university was really giving me anything. And so I ended up deferring at probably age 21 or something, and then spent the next 10 years of my life just traveling around and exploring other aspects of life and the university of life. And that's where I actually had the greatest learnings, and through those experiences, you know, I explored all sorts of worlds, from the shamanic worlds through to one of the things that I did was that I was fascinated with psychology, was Jungian psychology and mythology, and in particular the hero's journey. As I was traveling around the world, I began, one of the things that inspired me actually was reading this article about the indigenous, the Aboriginals here in Australia, when they gather and perform a corroboree on sacred land, and they sing their stories, their songlines, and they share their story, and they reenact the story that was of that place, everything prospers. The animals, the plants, and the rainfall, the climate, everything prospers. And that fascinated me, actually. I became fascinated with sacred place. What is a sacred site? And then as I began researching this, the journey took me all around Australia to Australian sacred places, and I discovered that they all had a unique story. And in this story, there was a hero. And so this actually took me around the world for my first journey around the world. And once again, it was a mission of mine to explore sacred places and to discover the stories behind these sacred places. And so, yeah, all around the world, I noticed there was a theme going on here, that each story had a hero. And then I thought, oh, I'm onto something here. I'm going to write a book. and so I started putting it all together. And then I discovered, oh, Joseph Campbell had already written that book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. However, that the essence of that story is, I guess, what led me to start my first, I thought it was a business at the time, but it was actually a social enterprise. After I ended up staying in an ashram for several years in India, came back, and I was just inspired to my mission statement at that time was to nourish, to inspire, to educate, to the future leaders of our world. And so I put together a program, and it was actually targeting boys, because I really, you know, saw that there was an issue here where the male, the masculine, was somewhat lost the identity was somewhat lost in this modern world, and that was probably due to a lack of rites of passage. Women, there's a natural and obvious rites of passage that they go through in their lives, you know, as they go through puberty. But for men, what is our rites of passage? That's a whole other topic. But anyway, I focus this program on for boys, and this program was about the hero's journey, and I was targeting, you know, for me it was about developing the future leaders of our world, you know, to give them the skills and the tools to become these leaders. But what I noticed actually was that this program was actually attracting boys that were disengaged from the school system, that were falling through the cracks, that were and they were benefiting from it immensely. And I even got asked to be a behavior management teacher at a particular school because of the program. But the thing is that at that point, this was like in the early 2000s, I didn't have the skills or the resources at that point. In fact, this is when I realized it wasn't a business at all, it was more of a social enterprise. I really wasn't making any money from it. But unfortunately, the thing that got me more than anything was that for the people in need, the boys that needed it the most, their parents, they tended to come from disadvantaged families. They couldn't afford to pay for the program. And so they unfortunately couldn't afford the program. And so I began looking for government grants or sponsorship. And as I said, I didn't quite have the skills at that time to be successful in winning any of that stuff. But I came across this wealthy entrepreneur, and he had managed to build a number of schools for boys or for kids that were kicked out of the school system. And he did it with his own profits. So he didn't rely on any government or any other sponsorship. So something about that really, I guess, awakened something in me. And it was a real shift at that point in my life. I realized that I actually needed to learn more about money. And so I then started years of studying money and from different areas. One of the first things I did after years of studying, and I started off just by going to different wealth seminars or, you know, stuff like that. And then I became like a buyer's agent where I helped people buy investment property or property that could be developed so you could make some money. And so for me, the whole thing was around positive cash flow property, you know, it just property that looks after itself and then can give you some income. Or that you could develop, that you could, you know, find the highest, if you could find the highest potential of a property, then it unlocks the wealth of that property. And that's, so I started off down there, and then I began around 2010 getting questions from people, because then the legislation started to allow people to use their super to buy a property. And I began getting all these questions around that, and I realized that I couldn't answer them. So that's when I thought, I need to do more study. So I ended up doing more study and getting my qualifications as a financial advisor. And while doing that, my whole world got opened up to a whole other spectrum of money as well. But the interesting thing is that during that period, there's a real pendulum swing. I went from a pretty much a social enterprise, which was not about the money, but about solely about the purpose of helping these boys in need, all the way through to a financial planning business, which was all about money. So after about a year of actually running this financial planning business, I had just recently, my wife and I bought a property in the Eco Village, and this was the start of, I believe, a coming back home to the center, to my heart space and to who I really am. Okay, because in life, we can be pulled in different directions, but ultimately, you need to find your ikigai, your reason for being. This is your destiny, your purpose, and when you found that, everything flows. You got that too. While I was operating, had my office here in the village, and then someone, one of the residents, came to me and he asked. He said, "Can you tell me about ethical investing?" And so this was about 6 years ago, and as he said that, the penny dropped, and I was like, "Oh my God, where have I been?" I knew that that was my next step. Was actually, and this for me was the balance between like a business that is just for purpose or non-profit and not making any money, and businesses that are solely just for making money. And so so I dive deep into that, and there's been a massive the whole world is evolving over the last 6 years around this, and this is part. We're definitely in evolutionary times where our relationship to self, to government, to money, to corporations, it's all changing, and so it's purpose and business is now starting to merge. It needs to, because we've seen the negative impact of just chasing after money. What damage that has done, not only to the planet, but also to people and communities as well. So that's I guess a journey of where I started to where I am now in a bit of a nutshell.
That's amazing. There's so many things I'd like to unpack there. Just for those people who are listening, when it came out of context, I showed my notebook up to the camera to show Adrian that I'd have Ikigai written down next to me. I read it in an article about how Japanese people have so many centenarians, whatever they're called, people who live over 100 or 200, and that's one of their reasons why, is because they have a reason why. And so that was fantastic. And did you say, was it called Asham you lived in? Asham?
Ashram.
Ashram. And so, and what was that like? What did you do there?
Yeah, so what ended up what guided me there ultimately was after I actually finished my degree, like I ended up after traveling and then discovering the hero's journey, I felt like, oh well, now I've found my purpose. And by the way, the purpose, there's a great book that explores this, which is David Deida, The Way of the Superior Man. And it explains purpose like an onion, where there's, different layers start to unfold. And that's actually the first chapter in that book. And the and so yeah, my and each journey, when you listen to your heart, you follow your heart, takes you to that next level and the next level and the next level. So for me, gone are the days where you are in a job for 40 years and then you retire. No, that's not living. That's not life. Like, finding your ikigai is a lifelong journey, and it's one of the most fulfilling things anyone can do. So for me, after that initial travel around the world, and I discovered the hero's journey, and so I ended up finishing my Bachelor of Psychology, Bachelor of Arts, and then doing a grad to bed, and I thought, okay, this is what's gonna help me with my next part of my journey, is to be able to share my gifts with kids, and so, but the thing is, as soon as I finished that degree, I thought, no, I want to, rather than going straight out to get a job, I felt this deep yearning, actually, I just want to offer my service up to the greater, to the divine. And this is something that I have a deep connection with, is the great mystery. And so that's what I did. I went and offered my services in this ashram, and offered voluntary service in the ashram. And so for me, that was like being able to offer voluntary service as a way of just handing over my actions to the greater good. And it's so I did that. That's what led me to the ashram, and it was one of the most amazing times in my life. Incredible, amazing teachings, amazing people, and actually a lot of the teachings that I received there actually are the seeds that were planted in my life that are only just coming to fruition now. In ways like through my book, The Yoga of Wealth, and some online courses that I'm developing now.
Amazing. And so you're living in India at the ashram for how long?
I was living there for 2 years.
Yeah, fantastic. That's definitely a large part of service, you know, in terms of the part. And the reasons you left to move on, to continue the journey, or to... something happened, yeah. Or yeah
the India can be really hard on your body, and after 2 years my physical body wasn't quite coping anymore, and so there was that, and yeah, I just felt a pull. And actually there's some great Sufi stories, you know, you'll probably here that I love story. So for me, story and parable is the greatest way of learning and teaching. And there's a great Sufi story called Mojo, the man with the inexplicable life. And ultimately, that's the way he lives his life, is just by listening to the inner guidance. And at different points, you know, he might be working as a fisherman, but one day he just gets that calling to go, and he follows that. Ultimately, Mojo ends up a self-realized being, where his gifts are impacting everyone around him.
That's amazing. I'm learning about hero's journey and stories, and in terms of telling and how to get people engaged and things like that. We could sit here and talk about stories all day. They're just so amazing, you know. And that's not being smart. That's being like, it's just so amazing, the things that people have done, and what, you know, in terms of, you know, you've read lots of books and you've written one yourself, and how you get your people search for that message, and I guess. The message that people learn from reading or from stories can be personalized, and is quite different as well, depending on their circumstances. So it's great. So you did mention the yoga of wealth there. So expand on that if you can, Adrian.
Yeah, sure. So yoga is a Sanskrit word which means literally union. And the yoga of wealth is about uniting both our inner and outer experiences of wealth. So the understanding is that we have an inner world of our feelings, emotions, our mind, and then an outer world where we've got physical objects and work in the outer world. So these two worlds meet in the yoga of wealth. And there's I'm actually putting together an online course around the developing how we can develop or cultivate our inner wealth. And it's an important part, you see, because for some people, if they're devoting their life to building up like a wealth on the outside, you know, like houses, investments, all sorts of things, there's lots of stories that indicate that they end up being unfulfilled after all of that. And you know, so what's the point of all of that? You know, and so there's this is where, and then there's this other thing where some people, no matter what they do, they end up just attracting bad luck, or their money just never seems to stay, or there's some sort of a negative relationship with money. And so with my work or study around psychology, I also discovered that there's five main profiles, I guess, that explain or describe our attitudes or behaviors around money. And would you like me to
Yeah,
explain that?
yeah.
So there's
Is this the money personality? Yep, fantastic. Go into it.
So there's the freedom seeker. So the freedom seeker, they tend to enjoy experiences and adventure more than money. In fact, they tend to put their head in the sand around money. There's no fun there. So they'd rather chase experiences and fun, and so unfortunately, they tend to struggle with money. Then there's the visionary. The visionary is for them, money is a tool to be able to express themselves, and also to, if they've got a dream they want to achieve. So they tend to be your entrepreneurs. And then there's the nurturer. The nurturer sees money as a tool to be able to provide for others. And they just love giving money. Money is just there and just is given out to others. Then there is the planner. Now they love the numbers, and they can spend all day just crunching the numbers and working. They love the detail. And then there's the spenders. Now they're different to the nurturers. For them, it's more about spending for the self, for the, you know, self-gratification. And so there's five main profiles there. And of course, we have a bit of everything in us. They're not separate from each other. But there is one dominant one that that can, I guess, really guide or dominate our experience of how money shows up in our life. And so by understanding the strengths and the weaknesses around each of these, you can actually do work to be able to bring greater balance in your life with these. And you know, in the same way that your personality determines how you relate to other people, your money personality determines how money shows up in your life.
That's awesome. It's so interesting to hear all different types because I know I was one of the questions I had further down, so thanks for that. What personality are you?
I'm the
Dominant.
vision. Visionary is the dominant one. Yeah,
Yeah, I can definitely
but there's a mix of all the other ones too.
Yeah, when you were explaining, I was like, oh, I've got a little bit of this, I've got a little bit of that, you know. So it's hard to, put your percentages down. But yeah, I'm sure if I had a bit of a deeper look, I'd be at a on the spot. I'd potentially say visionary. I'm not too sure. I'm not big on, I don't need the newest clothes or anything, and I don't need. I'm also probably not going to buy the most amazing gift either. So I'm not a nurturer. But it's about, I guess, yeah, as you said, a mixture as well. So.
Yeah, and if you want to find out exactly what it is, I do have a link on my website where you can book in a session, a 15-minute call to find out what your unique money personality is.
Yeah, I'll definitely put that link in the description as well. I did have a look at that today as well. Fantastic. And so is that what the book's about? Is that part of, I know, I've got another question.
It's part of it. Like there's a number of things. So one of the things that that I explore in the book regarding inner wealth is understanding that actually in life there's fundamental laws of creation that govern all of life. Gravity is one that you might know, right? Everything here on this planet is governed by the law of gravity. But similarly, there's laws of prosperity that actually nature follows. If you look at nature is just naturally abundant. And so there's teachings there. And for me, in my journeys through shamanism and in the ashram, what I understood is that nature is one of our greatest teachers. And certainly, just by observing nature, you can see these laws in practice. And so part of the book is about aligning with the natural laws of prosperity as well, and how you can do that. You know, and one, for example, is quite common. You know, it's what you focus on grows, and there's a scientific explanation to that regarding psychology of the brain, and there's a certain cognitive bias that the brain naturally leads us to, and so what you focus on grows. We see more of that in our life, you know, the red car syndrome, and it's part of life everywhere as well.
And that kind of leads me into my next, I guess, question or statement. So in, I don't know if it's in the book, but you talk about the four Indian principles of purpose, prosperity, pleasure, and presence. Are they in the book as well? And if they are, or yeah, if they're not, could you explain those separately?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually begin the book with that. You see, the in Sanskrit, it's a concept known as Purushartha, which can be loosely translated to mean the goal of human life, or the human endeavor, the purpose of human life. And so in Sanskrit, there are four main goals of human life: Artha, Kama, Dharma, and Moksha. Okay, so, and they relate to each of these four ideas that you just mentioned before. Now, I'm just going to pause there for a moment and just reflect on a psychological concept known as Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's like a Western understanding of how to live a fulfilled life. And if you look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the top of the pyramid there is self-actualization, okay? So, and it sees that that's a goal. And yeah, you know, ultimately, self-actualization is the goal. And down the bottom of the pyramid there, we've got our survival needs, you know, of shelter, food, water. So, and according to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's really hard to move up that pyramid to self-actualization when you haven't fulfilled the needs below. Okay, so that's interesting. Whereas in this concept, Purushartha, this is thousands of years old, by the way. It's a Vedic understanding. So Artha is like a wealth that money is an intrinsic part of living a fulfilling life. It just is. Then we've got actually Dharma, Dharma is the Sanskrit word, and it means purpose. You know, what is your purpose, your dharma, here in this on this planet? We all have our own unique dharma or purpose. By tuning into that, you'll have a more fulfilling life. And then there's Kama, K-A-M-A, and this relates to the body, pleasure. And so unlike a lot of old or religious constructs, and even some parts of Indian constructs, they tend not to they tend to go away from the body. The body is evil, you know, like old Christianity type stuff. The body is evil. However, in this understanding, through pleasure, by becoming conscious of our senses, by bringing consciousness to each of our senses, it is intrinsic part of living a fulfilling life. And what I mean by that is rather than just seeing with our eyes, seeing with your third eye, with your vision, rather than just hearing with the ears, what can you hear beyond just the sounds and touch, you know, like rather than just see if you can just touch consciously, bringing conscious touch to anything that you do. It takes it to another level. So that is karma. And then finally moksha is spiritual liberation, which is the same as Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the self-actualization. That's total freedom. However, in Purushartha, what they say is that each of these four aspects are not mutually exclusive. They're actually a part of each other. You need to experience all of them to be able to have a truly fulfilling life. So to go away and live in an ashram and just focus on moksha, on consciousness, ultimately, it's not going to lead to a totally fulfilling life in this understanding. Or just focusing on money, it's not going to lead to a totally fulfilling life. Or just focusing on bodily pleasures and having sex every day or all day long, that's just not going to be ultimately fulfilling. So by bringing it all together, okay, that is the key to fulfilling human life.
Amazing explanation. I really enjoyed that. I was I might not have been smiling or nodding along, but I was definitely I was quite focused in what you were saying. So thanks again. That was awesome. It's really interesting to hear all the different, you know, concepts and how things are, you know, done Eastern, Western, you know, modern, historically. And it's kind of all, it's like, hang on, this is the same story here. It's just been told a different way. Why can't we all just, you know, do what we're told? You know, people have been trying to tell us for ages, you know. And that, I guess that comes...
Well, that's the human mind, isn't it? You know, we and this is one of the things, we need a new way of being told it. It's just human nature. We need to be told a different way hundreds of different times. It's just that thing, you know, the mind, the human mind is always gravitates towards something new. Oh, what's that? I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's a few things I want to try, I guess, grasp here. And I guess, you know, molding all four into having, you know, a fulfilled and, you know, sustainable life, is it, it takes time, doesn't it? It's not something that you can, you know, I think I've caught on pretty early, and I'm pretty stoked about that. You know, self-awareness, self-actualization. I wouldn't say I'm at the top, but I know why I'm here and what I want to do and things like that at this age. And I think a lot of people, I was just in a webinar earlier about leadership, and they got to this section where they had, I can't remember, but it's like 60 to 70% of adults are in this mindset, you know, 20 to 30% are in this mindset, and there's like 1 or 2% of the population who are at this top, you know, top performing part of life. And I was like, hang on, like, what are all these people doing? Why is 60 to 70% down below? And I guess my reflection is after hearing that is they're not they're just, you know, going with the flow. They're just getting on the tram, going to work. You know, they're not, like you said, they're not pausing, looking at nature, focusing on the, you know, their presence. They're not focusing on pleasure or, you know, nature. What's their purpose? Things like that. So I think when not Google those things, but once you kind of sit down and have a reflect and think about what you're doing, you might be able to, I guess, get into that growth stage or figure out a bit more about what's going on and why you're here and things like that. So that's fantastic. And then hopefully, you know, those things lead into what I've even spoke about, a different culture, about Ikigai and things like that. So they're all kind of intertwined. And so what's it like being an author? So putting all your, you know, I guess your thoughts on paper, it's a good feeling. Is it hard? Did you, you know,
it's an interesting journey. It took me probably 3 to 6 months to get it all down. Like I would, you know, just self-published. But the interesting and unexpected feeling that came up for me was once I'd finished it, it was like, oh, actually, this doesn't feel relevant anymore. And I've actually spoken to other authors about this, and they say the same thing. It's there's a sense of like, oh, now this is old news now, and why would the world want this? You know, it's like I completed something, and now I need to move on, and I've already got new understandings, new wisdoms, new insights, and all this just seems like old news. And but then my coach at the time said, look, yeah, you have moved on, that's fine, but what about all the other people that haven't got this awareness yet? You know, this is what this is for, this is why you wrote the book. And so it was like, okay, yeah you're right.
Yeah, I'm experiencing that now in my PhD. I'm hopefully finalizing a few manuscripts at the moment, and I'm like, I wouldn't say I'm over. I'm just like, I've read this a billion times. I've written it with my team. We've had their input, my input. Let's just get it out there. The world needs to know this stuff, and because I want to move on, right? I want to get to my next paper. I'm going to start my second year of my PhD. I need to move on. Whereas I'm like, hang on, well, they don't actually know this yet, because me and my team are four of the only people who have this information. So.
Yeah.
We need to share it. And it's not saying that we don't want to know about it anymore, but we've, like you said, we're moving up the ranks, you know. We've found the next thing. It's like you said, with the brain looking at something that's new all the time. It's like, all right, we've, you know, potentially, you know, we've mastered this. What can we... We've got that under the belt. Let's keep going. So, I can imagine it's a hard process to... Even to let go of it. All right, cool. It's gone now. Let's push through. So... And so what about your pathway to, I guess your pathway to freedom, and I guess, you know, in terms of financial investment and ethical investment. So how, obviously you spoke about your journey to where you're up to now, but what does ethical investment mean to you? Well, what do you tell people? Do people just think, all right, well, if I invest in OzHarvest, that's an ethical investment, or I invest in palm-free oil, is that an ethical investment? Like, how do people come to you, and what do you tell them?
Yeah, so that's, for many people, it's a journey as well, and it typically starts first by becoming more conscious of what we consume every day in our lives, and how and where we spend our money, and so money is essentially just a medium through which we exchange value, and so the question I like to ask people is how. And where are you placing your value? Okay, so, instead of budgeting, I call this area conscious cash flow. And so by becoming more aware of how and where you're spending your money, like, and that includes buying ethically, looking for companies that have demonstrated their commitment to social and environmental responsibility, buying locally, because when you buy local, studies show that up to 70% of that money stays in the local community, passing through all the different hands, benefiting more people. Okay, and participating in a sharing economy as well, like tool libraries, clothes libraries, all those sorts of things. means that, you know, why do we all have to own so much stuff? You know, there's having access to community-owned assets can mean less waste going to landfill, and it'll save us money as well. So this is all part of what I call conscious cash flow. It's a little bit different to budgeting. But ultimately, then that leads to a journey where the person then starts to ask questions about, oh, well, what about my larger assets? And for many people, their second largest asset is their super. It is the retirement savings. And the thing is that most people have no idea what their super is invested in. And I've come across a lot of people who might be conscious around what they're consuming, but yet their super is still supporting industries that are destroying the planet and communities. So it's like an evolution of understanding around money. But ultimately, the second largest asset, there are ways of being able to make sure that it is supporting companies that are making a positive contribution to the planet and to people in need. And that's absolutely possible. And that's what I specialize in as well. There's, yeah, so yeah, that's pretty much that in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah, I really resonate what you're saying there about value. You know, I have potentially had to move to Melbourne earlier this year, and I probably might still go depending how things turn out. But I looked around in my room, and you can see on the shelves here, there's a bunch of junk behind me, and I'm still trying to, slowly. Well, this is my childhood room, you know, so I'm trying to get rid of things as I age, and I'm like, well, this doesn't provide me any. What you said, there's value, you know. And I kind of think of that when I go to purchase things now. I'm like, all right, I'm going to buy this container to eat my lunch in. Well, yeah, that provides me value, okay, because I need it every day, and it will last me 50 years because it's a plastic container. I'm fine, you know, or a glass one or whatever I decide to pick. Or if I'm going to pick a shirt, like I've already got a cupboard full of shirts. Do I need another one? It's not going to provide me more value to the other shirts in my cupboard, you know, just because it's got a higher price tag or it's a comfier fit, it's still going to be the shirt on my back. So I'm slowly realizing these things in terms of, like, I don't need a lot. I need a good cup of coffee in the morning. I need a book. I need a computer and some internet, you know, a house to live in and a partner and some friends and family. Like, that's about it. Throw in some exercise and some good food. I'm pretty set. You know, there's not a lot of other value that I see in other things.
So, like, for instance, the hat you're wearing, right?
Yeah.
So, I just went through that buying decision this week, actually. My old hat is worn out, and it's this happens with clothing and different stuff, material stuff. So it's like, okay, where am I going to buy a new hat? And there's a bunch of companies out there that are demonstrating a commitment to environmental and social responsibility. So there's one hat company that with every hat you purchase, they plant 10 trees, okay? And there's another one there that they've got stats on their packaging and, you know, how much, you know, the recycling that they use. So that's a way as well. Like, when you do have to use your money, it's by becoming more conscious of the company that you're purchasing through. Are they doing the right thing with your money? So there's that as well. And then, you know, when it comes time to, if you've got some capital and then the question arises, well, where do I invest this capital? That'll come up. The best question to ask yourself is, what value is this investment going to bring me, my family, my community, and the planet? And this is where I think that's the important question that everyone needs to ask themselves before investing. What's happened is that there's been this culture of chasing after money. But why? You know, you got these short-term traders, or even like cryptocurrency at the moment. There's this, the chasing after money. What's the actual purpose behind it? And so when you get in touch with the value and purpose behind it, you are going to receive so much more value than just monetary returns. And by the way, the financial returns from companies or ethical or impact funds are actually outperforming the market, the index, as well. And for the long term, okay? So things like cryptocurrency is actually considered a speculative asset class, and so it has a role to play, but it's not the only asset that you would have in your investment portfolio.
I think it's also driven what other people think, that other people think of them. Like I just had an example in my head when you were explaining that, like, all right, well, if you have a really rare item, you can't take it with you when you die. No one's going to know that you had it. In 5 years, 10 years' time, let's go 100 years' time. Say I buy a really rare, poster signed by Darth Vader or something like that, right? That is not going to... It might be value in terms of you like Star Wars, or it's a rare piece, or it costs a lot of money, but it doesn't do anything. It just sits there on the... It might provide... I guess you get into the argument of this. When I look at this, it provides me joy, or it gives me a memory of when I was a kid and I liked Star Wars. That's a hard argument, I think. But in the greater picture of ethical investment, that is a poor investment. Like, it is... No one, Jimmy down the road is not going to be like, oh, you see, Nathan's got that new Darth Vader poster. There's only five of those. Like, he's going to forget about that tomorrow. He doesn't care, you know. It's like when you see someone in a really fancy car, you don't even know who it is. You're like, oh, cool. And then you drive your own car, you forget about it because it's not important to you. It's a difficult thing for people to understand, I think. But you're like, say this hat, this isn't even mine. I'm like, cool, whatever. It's a white hat. You know, it's got Bali written on it. I've never been to Bali. I like it. Let's wear it. If I lose it, you know, big deal. I've got 10 other hats, you know. And, you know, in 5 years' time, I'll probably have two hats because that's all I need.
And then that'll end up in landfill. I mean, this is... And this... See, the thing is that it's a really tricky journey, just like anything in life.